It's wonderful to be welcoming Philip Lynch back on the programme. Philip, how are you?
Not too bad at all, Shirley. Sure, we're still alive in these troublesome times, which is, I suppose, a positive end to it.
That is a positive. And it's an entirely new year since we last spoke.
Oh, yes, yes, it is, yeah.
So hopefully we're going in the right direction and towards...
About it, as a younger man, I often thought, would I see the year 2000? And now this is 2022.
There you are. So
we've lived quite a bit.
We're doing well.
We're survivors.
That's it. We are resilient.
I am, anyway, at 83. However, anyway.
Perfect. Now, I know that my listeners were very, very intrigued and fascinated the last time you came on to talk to us about the Irish people in the West Indies, in particular Barbados. But I understand that you have a story about an Irishman in Malta for us today.
Yes, yes.
Great.
I have. Yes, when my son got married back a number of years ago, I was running the farm up to that and all the rest, and when he got married, I made the farm over to them, and I took the farm retirement then that time.
Yes.
Now, we gave a hand and all the rest to keep myself active and all the rest of it, and I was the gopher. And we worked away. But then when I had to draw the old age pension, then at 66, you had to change over, and I did. And when it came to that, I said to the missus, well, look at... We are officially now on holiday.
Yes.
And we have an advantage insofar as that we can go abroad off season. So we went to the sun. Three times a year then I said we go to the sun, and it would be very good to us. We'd get in the vitamin D, which the Irish are very deficient in because we don't see the sun. And we'd go out there, and it might help to give us better health and enjoy life better. So we did. And when it came to January, we went to Malta. And when we went to Malta, we found out there was an Irishman buried there. Now, I didn't hear that when we were coming home. But when I heard it at the time and heard that he had been a sailor, I went up to the Kalkara Military Cemetery in Valletta. And I couldn't succeed in finding him there.
Okay.
So when I came home then, I went to look up this man to see where he was, and suddenly I found that he had, his grave was adorned every day by fresh flowers.
Oh, still?
And he died around about 1837, and I was wondering to know what. So this started me to look for him. So I found out then that he had been a young man from Kentorkan, County Cork. And he was a son of Bridget MacSweeney. His name was Thomas MacSweeney of Kintork.
Okay, and Kintork, of course, is not a million miles away from his here at all in West Limerick.
Your area of the country.
Yes.
So we're talking about a man from Munster and down just below you. And this intrigued me at the time. You know, you get Irishmen everywhere on earth.
That's
in
it.
Any country you go to. And they have marked their presence by in history by their startling discoveries or startling achievements. And this man was maybe not an achiever, but he was a man that made his mark.
Yes.
In Malta. Now, when I found out he was born in Kintork in 1814, about the year, about 21 years of age, he went into Cork looking for a job. And of course, Cork at that time, all along the Lee, it was all dockland along there, and ships docked all along up the river. And of course, then the pubs, the men that worked on the ships went in and out to pubs there along like that. But apparently he went into one of the pubs or whatever, but he was grabbed by the press gang. There was a British military ship in Cork, and of course what used to happen is when they come in, somebody might die aboard the ship or maybe not turn up, and they couldn't leave without a full complement.
Sure, they needed their quotas.
And they grabbed anyone that would look like being able to serve aboard the ship, preferably young men, and they might lure them into a false sense of security by maybe offering them drink or whatever. When they got drunk, then they were grabbed and put aboard the ship, and when they woke up or whatever, they were far out to sea, so they could do nothing about it.
Sure.
Now, the British always went along in southern England, around about the Celtic lands of Devon and Cornwall and Wales, to grab any unsuspecting young man to serve aboard the ship, because really nobody would serve on the British ships at that time apart from officers.
Yes.
They wouldn't, because it was a rough life, and if you went against the regulations or the rules, you were flogged at will on the place. In order to keep order on the ship, it was rough treatment, and nobody really would join the British Navy at the time, and as a result the press gang operated fairly freely in ports when they arrived. But anyway, he was grabbed and put aboard the ship, and then he was put aboard the Rodney, which was a new battleship at the time, and that was It had over 92 guns. It was a fine big vessel.
It must have been big.
It was, yeah. And he was put on board that. Now, he was a Catholic on a Protestant boat. And as a result, being an Irishman and a Protestant, he got the rough end of the stick always. And he found it hard to keep in with some of the officers as such. But one day, he was on deck, and an officer accused him of something he wasn't guilty of, and he and the officer had an argument, and they were off Spain around Barcelona on patrol. This would be after the Napoleonic Wars, around 1837.
Yes.
And he had a dispute with the officer over this, and then he either pushed or punched the officer, and the officer fell through a hatch onto a lower deck and broke his neck and was killed.
Oh, goodness.
Now, the Irishman, then, of course, then was brought up, court-martialed as such for the offence, and they knew he was going to be given a hanging sentence for it, but they didn't hang him there for the simple reason that they had another purpose to the opportunity that came up to them.
Yes.
And he was brought to Malta. Now, we have to go to the story of Malta. Malta, an island in the southern end of the Mediterranean, came into the ownership of the Knights Hospitallers of St. John, when, like all the Crusaders that went to the Crusades at the time at the appeal of the Pope because of the Saracen taking over the Holy Land and denying access to the sacred sites of Christendom to the Christian. And then, of course, the Crusades were organized to free the Holy Land from the Saracen as such. And they fought hard on and ruled it well for about 100 years, but after that it became more difficult. And then, of course, they were eventually had to retreat from the Holy Land, and the Knights Hospitallers and the Templars, but the Knights Hospitallers came on to Rhodes, the island of Rhodes, at that time. And eventually, the Ottoman Empire that ruled Turkey, and that drove them off at that particular time. So, it was Charles V. They appealed to the Emperor Charles V, for a homeland.
Yes.
And they were given the homeland in, they were given the homeland and the island in 1530 by Charles V. And it was ruled then by the Knights of St. John and the Grand Master that used to rule that. Now, there was about 20,000 natives on it at that particular time. And, of course, then the Knights of St. John set up a boat yard in the Grand Harbour, which was a fine harbour there in Malta. And of course, the British used it well in the last war as well. It was able to accommodate quite a number of battleships and all the rest of it. But it was a large harbour, and they set up a boat yard in it and employed a lot of the local people. So they were welcomed in the area. And of course, Malta before that had been ruled by the Romans and the Carthaginians before that as well.
Yes.
But then the Knights of St. John then ruled it from then on. Now, they built, being a military of the Catholic Church, they built a whole lot of churches for their service and that in as Catholic churches.
Sure.
And built 365 of them, one for every day of the year.
Oh, marvellous.
Between the two islands. And they were all decorated at the time to vie with the beauties of the church in churches in Rome. So they're all beautiful churches.
Yes.
That are well done. And there were, of course, there were all parish churches as well for different areas of that at the time. Then, of course, afterwards, they then fortified the place because they were actively involved in the Mediterranean controlling the Ottoman Empire and the pirates of Algeria, the Algerines at the time. There were lots of pirates there at that time, and they controlled them well at the Knights of St. John. Now, they acquired a lot of booty and all the rest, and of course, when they caught and a lot of prisoners, they forced them into service as on their galleys.
Of course.
As galley slaves and all the rest of it. And then, of course, they had the speed and those ships to overtake anything, and they controlled the Mediterranean from there. They were constant enemies of the Ottoman Empire, and then in 1565, the Ottomans besieged Malta, and they brought a whole army of around 20,000-30,000 onto the island, and then, of course, they tried to besiege Valletta and went into the harbour, but the Knights of St. John had all their defensive buildings on their castles and all around the harbour, which overlooked the harbour. The land rises over the harbour in all squares, so that you can fire down a night and comes into the harbour. And they really wiped out the Ottomans in the thing. Now, it lasted for quite a length of time, and eventually a relieving force, when the Knights of St. John were under the most stress at the time, a relieving force arrived on the island, and, of course, the Ottomans were wiped out. And after that battle, the Ottoman Empire was declining after that. That was the great siege of Malta. Now, as a result, the local people fought and learned to fight with the Knights of Malta as such, and they went through a relative time of peace after that. Then, of course, you had the French Revolution, which changed the thing, because when the French Revolution happened, Napoleon went to Egypt. And when he was going to Egypt with his army, he pulled into docked in Malta.
Yes.
Now, the locals fired on him from when he tried to attempt to come into the harbour. But then Napoleon ordered Valletta to be shelled. And when the shell started to fall on the place, Humpesh, the last of the last grandmaster of Malta, he abdicated and left because he was going to cause a problem. So the French went in and ruled the island.
Yes.
And Napoleon left then for Egypt. And when he left for Egypt, he left a garrison on Gozo, the other island, along with Malta. There are two islands on it.
Right.
And he left the garrisons there. When on, the French garrison started to rob the churches of all the silver and gold that the Knights of St. John, the Knights Hospitallers, the Knights of Malta had put into their churches.
Oh, so they started looting as soon as he left.
Yeah, so the locals went up in arms. This wasn't going to happen to their churches.
Good.
So they attacked the garrison in Gozo and wiped them out. Then they attacked the garrison in Malta, the island itself, and they ran into the formidable defensive works that were there around Valletta, and nobody could get at them. Now, the Maltese built a line of defence around the outside so they couldn't get out for food. But then the French began to supply them from the sea. So the Maltese contacted the British, who were fighting Napoleon, and, of course, to blockade the port. So the British did.
Yes.
And eventually, after about a year, the French abdicated and left. Now the British were in. And under the Treaty of Amiens, they were allowed to act as protectors of the island, but nothing else.
Right.
Then after Waterloo, the British saw the advantage of this big harbour there, that they could have their ships in it, and as a lot of the ships now were being transferred over to the new power source of coal as steamers.
Yes.
And they looked at this as being a refueling point, and with plans being put in motion to build the Suez Canal, this would be an ideal harbour on their way to India, and as a result, consolidate and make the ruling of their empire a lot simpler. So Malta became a cherished territory. So they went in.
Of course. Weren't they always willing to exploit whatever territories that they landed on, weren't they?
Of course. But you see, they expanded the shipyard.
Yes.
And gave more employment to the Maltese. Now, there's about 400,000 of the population there at the present time. But at this time, the population expanded and they had jobs in the boater yards, etc., etc.
Yes.
So the locals accepted them. Well, they had little choice because there were a small number of people in a big society.
Of course.
So they accepted them at the time, and the British worked along well. That was grand. It was lovely. Anyway, so the Suez Canal was being built then afterwards, and that would give access across there and that line, sort of a cherished place then. Now, they went in, they put in a lot of personnel, and their army went in, and their navy, and then they suddenly dawned on they had no place for Anglican service.
Okay.
So they set up at the time, had their services then in the palace, near the square in the centre of Valletta. But then they were very disgruntled. They said, look, there's 365 churches here with the Maltese. They don't want all of those.
Yes.
So they said, now we'll take over St. John's Cathedral in Valletta. John's Cathedral in Valletta is called St. John the Baptist Cathedral, and it's a beautiful cathedral, the nicest church in Christendom, bar St. Peter's, because it's beautiful augment. All the ceiling is all painted, all the scenes of John the Baptist's life, and above over the altar is the baptism of Christ John the Baptist, and a beautiful piece of sculpture. And the whole lot is so beautifully decorated in the Baroque style.
Yes.
And all the side chapels and all the rest are given over to the different lounge or the different regiments from the different countries that were members of the Knights of Malta at the time. And it's a beautiful cathedral. Wonderful. And the floor is their burial place. And all the inlaid marble on the tombs, every night is given a 6x3 flat on the floor. And the beauty of those gravestones is something to behold. But however, then the British went about taking over this.
I'm guessing that they wanted to choose the nicest church.
Yes, oh, beautiful church.
Yes.
But the Maltese were totally appalled. Now the French were bad enough. They were taking the
Yes.
But the British were taking the whole church.
Yes.
So they were up in arms against the British over this. And they appealed to the Pope, and the Pope stood with them. And the cardinal in Malta said, no way is there going to be an Anglican service in any of our churches.
Yes.
So the British thought this was a very bigoted attitude as such. And then they changed their mind and they went to take over the Jesuit church.
Okay.
But they weren't having anything either. So they flatly refused them. And they were more or less, at this stage now, the British were afraid of their situation. If the local people went up in arms against them, they'd find themselves out on their ear like the French.
That's it, exactly.
So they pulled back anyway. And then they went for St. James's Church in the thing. But then St. James's Church was the same. They were all owned by the parishes and built by the... So no way were they going to give St. James's Church. So they got very annoyed about this. Now, at that same time, and to the time that Ponsonby was governor at the time, and Ponsonby was the most practical of the governors because he didn't want to shove the thing too far. He'd be the same Ponsonby's probably of Limerick in that too.
Yes.
And but he didn't want to shove the thing too far, so he kind of said, "Usher, look, we'll work away where we are." But then you see, Mike Sweeney had offended and was then to be hung. And they brought him to Mon. Could have been brought to which would have been nearer to Gibraltar, but he wasn't. When it happened then, the trouble in Malta, then they brought him into Malta.
Into Malta, yes.
And the Rodney was ordered back into Malta at the time, and he was prisonership, but brought into Malta, and then he was given two priests, there were two Maltese priests that ministered to them, before he was executed.
Right.
Now, the Rodney came in, and on that morning, in 1837, in the middle, it was parked in the middle of the harbour, and overlooked by Valletta, because it's on the higher ground, over the saluting station, where there is still a whole line of cannon, a saluting battery there in the thing, and it was underneath that, and in the middle of the harbour, where it could be seen, was the Rodney for the hanging. And all the ship's personnel were all ordered to be there. Some of the ships then came, made a ring around it, and there was a whole lot of military, marines, were all ordered. There was over 700 of them, all on guard, in case the Maltese did anything. As such, they were conscious of this. And the Maltese were ordered to be looking on and to see this thing as an egg to them, as what the British could do.
Sure, now, a public spectacle.
Now, you know what I mean?
Yes.
They denied that they put him up for you. But it is quite obvious that they were being thwarted by the Maltese, and they were wanted to show these people what they could
it
do.
It was a show of power, and McSweeney was the unfortunate victim of this show of power.
Yes. So, on the morning anyway, the prison ship came over and parked next to Rodney, and Thomas McSweeney was taken off and brought up to where he was to be hung on the deck. And the two priests, there were two Maltese priests, and they ministered to him. And then when the time arrived, the gun fired and the trap door opened, and poor Thomas McSweeney was hung.
Yes.
And then, in order that everybody would see what they had done, he was run up to the top of the yard arm on the main mast and left hanging there for about an hour so that everybody could see what was after happening.
What a great victory they had had.
To behave yourself.
Yes.
Then he was taken down and brought to the military hospital across the way from that on Virgo. And then the Maltese were appalled.
Of course.
They had found out that he was an Irish Catholic.
Yes.
And the reason he was an innocent man, because he hadn't murdered a man at all, and this came out at his trial.
Yeah, it was an accident.
And yet they condemned him to death because it was accidental. He had pushed him, but he didn't intend to kill him.
Yes.
So it wasn't premeditated murder, and he shouldn't have been hung. But they had found out this then from the priests and all the rest of it, so they looked for his body. And the British gave him his body. Now, he was brought down to St. Lawrence's Church and given all the rites of the church. And the confraternity of Valletta, the men brought him there, and they acted as pallbearers and a guard of honour. And he was brought from the church after Mass and everything, sung Mass, all the state or the religious ceremonies of the church were brought there. And he was brought down then to St. Lawrence's churchyard and buried there. And his grave had a whole lot of flowers from all the different confraternities of the island.
And his grave, you said his grave has flowers to this day?
Yes. So, now, we come to the point that that is the whole lot of that. Now, there's so many aspects to it. But when I heard this, I went looking, as I said to you, in Kalkara Cemetery, but yes, he wasn't there. And then I found out then it's Larne's Cemetery. So when we went the next time to Malta, myself and Nelly, we went along and we said we'd find this man. So we got the bus down as far as Birgu and got off at Ritchie was the bus stop and went in through the main gate, which is still, you know, is the most fortified area all around the harbour from ancient times and from the time of the Ottoman Empire that the Knights of St. John had built. And they are formidable. The walls of those are 8 foot, 10 foot thick in places, and the way they're built. But we went in through the gate into Birgu. Now, when we went in the gate, we were heading down towards St. Lawrence's Church, where the churchyard or cemetery we thought might be.
Yes.
And as we were going in the gate, this homely lady was out sweeping around what we took to be her house, just inside the gate, and she was sweeping along on the path with the brush. And I stopped and I said to her, excuse me, I said to her, where is St. Lawrence's churchyard?
Yes.
And she looked at me and she said, you were looking for Thomas Mulsweeney. I said, I am. Yeah, surprised. I said, I am. Oh, he's regarded as a saint here, she said. And there is a mass said every year. And when we do, when it said, he said, after Mass, there is a parade down to his grave, flowers on it. Oh, I said, that's right. Oh, yes, she said, but it's not here. She said, it's not here. She said, you have to go out the gate and you turn down Edward Street and go beyond the houses and down opposite the De La Salle College is St. Lawrence's churchyard.
Yes.
So back we went, and he went away, went down, and off down, and we went beyond the houses, and then there was this wall along at the far side, and we couldn't see anything, but there was another lady walking along the path. And I stopped her, and I said, excuse me, I said, where is St. Lawrence's churchyard, or St. Lawrence's cemetery?
Yes.
And she looked at me, and she said, what nationality are you? I'm Irish. Oh, said she, you're looking for Thomas Mulsweeney. She grabbed me and hugged me. Like, yes. I'm not that good looking now at the present time, but she hugged me and all, delighted, you've come to see his grave.
Yes.
Well, I said, we're looking for him. And she grabbed Nelly in the same way, delighted that we had come to see his grave.
Yes.
Oh, this was getting a bit out of hand.
Yes.
She said, yeah. Oh, she said, now, you have to go down further here. And that is the De La Salle College here on this side, she said. But on the other side, opposite the gate, is the entrance to St. Lawrence's cemetery. Now, she said, you go in the gate and over towards the mortuary, and you go up the steps to the left and go down to the graveyard, she said, and you come to a little well, St. Joseph's Well, and his grave is down near there. Right, I said, that was grand. Thanked her, she was delighted to go off. However, we went into the cemetery, and over and down to the left, and down to a little well where a lady was taking water out of.
Yes.
St. Joseph's Well. And I was looking around the graves and couldn't see any sign of this grave at all. So I stopped her and said, excuse me, I said, where is Thomas Mulsweeney's grave?
Grave, yes.
So she said, she said, it's over here, she said. I'm putting flowers on it. And there she was with her vase of flowers and the water put into them and all the rest. She was just putting on the flowers.
The flowers, beautiful.
We went over a little railing around it here in the corner, and on the wall was a statement, a little plaque. Sacred to the memory of Thomas Mulsweeney, executed on HMS Rodney on the 8th of June, 1837, aged 23 years. And that's on the wall to him.
Yes.
So, like, at this stage, there was 10 bunches of flesh flowers on his grave. And there was three lanterns with lighted candles in them as well.
Beautiful.
And she said to me, she said that we put a new plaque on it underneath, on the grave this time. Somebody took the portrait off the wall that we had there, she said. And we put a new one there with his name. And on one side was this more or less portrait of Thomas McSweeney,
yes,
in his sailor outfit. And on the other side was Christ across on it. So it was newly put by the people. And she said, we have cleaned it up and all, and it's very nice, she said now. But I was amazed at it. So he's regarded, and apparently there have been sightings of them at the time, and there have been cures attributed to them as well.
So he is, he's much revered in Malta.
Archive there because of this, he is so revered as such. But anyway, I was astounded at it.
That's an amazing story, Philip. And, yes, you know, isn't it astonishing to think that this man is so much revered in a different part of the world? And probably until today, I would say the majority of my listeners might not have heard of him at all.
No, and even we were down in Kanturk, and I was asking, and I went into a man by the name of O'Sullivan.
Yes.
And he had some indication of it, but he didn't have all the story. But to continue now with it, you see, that day, now I opened my eyes, but the morning afterwards I went into the cathedral, and as usual I was looking around because I'd be transfixed with all the paintings and the beauty of them.
Oh, of course, they're beautiful.
So I went in anyway, and I was looking around, and I sat down examining the thing, and this little lady came over to me, a smallish, thin little woman, and in the uniform of the staff in the cathedral.
Yes.
You pay to go into the cathedral, you're given a kind of an audio phone thing you read and tells you the whole story. You listen to it and you can change it around in different ways and where you are. So anyway, she said to me, you like the place. I said, I think this is marvellous altogether. But you wouldn't have it, only Thomas Mike Sweeney.
Yes.
I heard of that man. She said, but I don't know too much about him. I never told her then. I went down, and the women I met and all the rest of it, and she said, I'll get it up on my phone. So she got up to see on her phone.
Yes.
But I went. I was into the sacristy where there is a painting there by Caravaggio on the beheading of John the Baptist, one of the masterpieces of history.
Okay.
And it's lovely. I was looking at that, and in she comes behind me. And she said, I got this up on the phone, she said, and I see where it is now. Yeah, she said, I didn't think that he was as important as that. Oh, I said, he looked upon, according to the ladies, as a saint and a martyr.
As a saint, yeah.
So, says she. So, anyway, she said to me then, do you believe in angels? Well, I said, I don't know where I was before I was born in here. That's the main question. I don't know when I'm leaving.
Yes.
Of course, I said to him, with Christ's teaching and all the rest of it, there are angels and have appeared to people in different stories and all the rest, and they are there.
Sure.
I would agree, yes. Well, you've met three angels. How do you make that out? I said to her. Well, she said, they never asked you who you were looking for. But they didn't, I said. No. But when I mentioned St. Lawrence, I said, yeah. Well, they guided me in. They did, she said. They guided you in.
Yes.
So you met three angels. Thought to myself, I don't know. But however, morning afterwards, we went back to Burgu. Went down to where the lady was, to her house, to see could I have a chat with her.
Yes.
Went inside the gate, and I could find no house.
What?
And, where we were inside the gate where she was sweeping was only pavement. In behind it, there was a barracks belonging to the Knights of Malta, which is now vacant and all the rest of it, and that line. But there's no house there. So I went back down the street, but I'd have to go a good bit down before I found the first house.
Yes.
She wasn't there. So there was no place. So we went up to the cemetery, And, of course, we didn't meet the lady on the path, nor we didn't meet the woman in the
cemetery. At the well, yeah.
There was nobody there. So I came back the morning afterwards. I went into the cathedral to have a chat with this lady, since she was the last I had met.
Yes.
And I went in, and Tanya Andrews is the lady in charge in the cathedral. And I said, because I know her there over the time, and
sure.
I said to her, I'm looking for your staff member, I said, the little slight woman that was here yesterday, I said to her. Oh, she said, I don't know, I don't see any of our staff, she said, very slight, they're all very well proportioned, she said, I think you'll have a job to see anyone here like that. We don't have anyone by that description. But look around, she said, maybe you'd find the staff. So I went in, I looked around, and none of the staff, and she said, they're all here. None of the staff looked like the woman.
The woman that you'd met.
So, maybe I had four angels. I don't know. But that was our experience anyway.
Well, what a remarkable story. And a remarkable story of the finding of Thomas McSweeney as well.
But now, there's a further piece to it now as well. That was our experience with him. And he is a venerated there. But you would think that that might be all as to it, but in 1839, the Greeks and the Ottoman Empire were at war, and the Greeks were fighting their war of freedom against them. Now, Lord Byron, the poet, sided with the Greeks at the time, as you will remember. He was over there fighting with the Greeks at that time. But the British sent three warships down to Athens. One was the Rodney, that McSweeney had been hung on.
Yes.
The other was the Pembroke, and the third was the Dido. Now, they were sent to Athens, and they were there in Athens while this was going on, just to protect the British interests and all in the place. But then they left and were ordered back to Malta. Now, they were outside the port of Malta and about to enter it when a violent thunderstorm broke out. And a flash of lightning hit the Dido, or hit the Rodney on the main mast where McSweeney was hung,
yes.
And splintered it all in matchwood along the sea. It just vanished. And the second one was partially hit and brought down the sails, which went on fire. And the crew then were trying to put out the fire, but between the rain and all, they got to put it out. But the flash of lightning that hit the mast went out through the side of the ship and wrecked the ship. And the ship had to be towed into Valletta Harbour.
Valletta, sure.
And of course the Maltese were looking on, because they could see all this happening underneath them in the harbour.
Yes.
This thing. And here was Thomas McSweeney's ship, and the mast he had been hung on
splintered into the sea. Yeah.
And that reinforced their belief in the fact that Thomas McSweeney was a saint when the whole thing happened.
A saint and a martyr, yeah.
So now, they're the stories from the world as you move along.
What a marvellous story. As I say, you know, it's great to hear the story and to hear your experience of finding McSweeney. And, you know, it's amazing that he is so well revered in a different part of the world. And as I say, the majority of us here have probably never heard of him until this day.
Yeah, that's it. That's another one. Another a famous Irish man. And we will be going there now. We go every January.
Yes.
We always go down to his grave to say a few prayers for him and that. And, and there's a little tree growing there, a little pine tree that's grown near his grave. And we bring home the little seed pods. We bring them home.
Oh, beautiful.
The little Tory top or whatever is there. And we bring them home. And, if some of the children or some of the boys had an earache or a head... or a toothache, we bless the toothache with them, and hopefully they get a good result from it. But yes, that's where Thomas McSweeney is buried, the man from Kanturk,
not too far away.
Well revered in Malta.
Well, you know, it's a tremendous story. Like, he was an incredibly young man when he died. He was only 23. It's great that we're still talking about him,
Another little thing to it now, as we go. Now, when the British were refused entry to all the churches at the time, William the Fourth's wife, Queen Adelaide, he died, I get the date now here in this, William the Fourth died around about, Queen Adelaide, William the Fourth died in June 1837. That was the same time that McSweeney was hung.
Sure.
In 1837.
1837,
now,
same year.
Queen Adelaide, then his widow, she was advised at winter time to have it easier, to go to Malta. It was a lovely climate at this time of the year now in January. It's lovely. So
sure.
She was advised to go for her health to Malta. And as it was owned by the English, she went down. And when she went in, of course, there was no place for Anglican service. Only the room at the palace. So she was totally dissatisfied with this and inquired and found out that the Maltese had refused any of the churches for Anglican service. So there was a site available at the German Auberge. They were the German garrison. And the site there over the harbour, and she bought it. And out of her own money, her own contribution, she built the cathedral that's there now. And it's the only Gothic cathedral, the only Gothic church that's standing up in the middle of Valletta. And it's there over the harbour and there. And that then, she fixed them up there, and they now have a place for Anglican service. But at the present time, when the British garrison is gone, and Malta is an independent country in the EU, I say the number of people that go there to service in the Anglican cathedral, I'd say, are very few. But it is there for anyone. And, of course, we're all Christian, whether we're Anglican or not. We're all Christian. And
exactly.
We have to value what Christianity is about. It's very simple. It's just love your neighbour, do good for people. And those that are in trouble, through health or otherwise, or whatever, have misfortune, that we help them out. And that is the whole law of Christianity, whether you're a Protestant or a Catholic. Regrettably, it is being neglected at the present time. But whether you're an atheist or whatever, it's still the same. If you're not enjoying this life, you should do something about it in order that you do. Because even if you have a lot of money, you'll never bring any of that with you when you die.
Exactly.
I often love the idea that when I pass along, the prospect of paradise I cherish dearly.
Yes. And you have to make your own happiness, don't you?
Yes, well, of course, and help people out. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's it now. So that's the whole story. I think I've hit everything all along, and how it all happened and all the rest of it.